Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and again, it gives me great pleasure to announce that this is another magazine podcast. This time, we have journeyed across the Atlantic to South America, into Brazil, into Rio, and to Flamengo. Now, before we discuss the magazine, its contents, the all-important when it goes on sale date and when it runs out date and the smell and all the normal stuff that we like to chat about, I would like to introduce co-hosts for this edition and the new name that I gave everyone today in the email because I had to type really quickly. So this is now just the Mag Crew. So first of all, first founder member of the Mag Crew, Stephen Scragg. Stephen, welcome to the Mag Crew and to this podcast.
Makes me feel like I should be wearing a pair of jeans back to front or something like that, or, you know, scratching myself in places my mother would disapprove of if she was still around.
Looking forward to this podcast, other than wearing your jeans back to front? You're looking forward to it?
Very much so. Yeah, this team is just, you know, wonderful, you know, evocative from my childhood for, you know, very big reason. You know, iconic, you know, wonderful players from that team that supplied players to another version of that team on an international stage. And yeah, you know, for me, they are, I mean, there are other Brazilian clubs, you know, obviously, and people had kind of prodded us to do, you know, various clubs over the years. And, you know, other Brazilian sides have been mentioned. But for me, this is the Brazilian side simply because they're just so hardwired to my youth. So, you know, as soon as we were going Brazil, you know, this had to be the first direction that we went into.
I fully agree and support all of what you just said there. I can't add to it. I just absolutely, totally and utterly agree with you. Second co-host, second founder member of the Mag Crew, Aidan, welcome to the podcast and the Mag Crew.
The Mag Crew, yes, it's definitely got the 80s vibe, even if it wasn't for Stephen's memories of Flamengo in the 80s. Just the sheer name, Mag Crew, makes me think 80s and all sorts of aggro that could be going on. So that's what we're into, apparently. But to continue what Stephen was saying on Flamengo, he's right when he says this is the Brazilian club to focus on. It's just so evocative, so exotic. I've got a huge fondness for the kit. I think their shirt is absolutely delightful, glorious red and black. When it's horizontal stripes, I think that brings an extra thing to it that elevates it above AC Milan's red and black. There's just something equally about South American kits and Brazilian kits that are more special and they're more fancy and more different than we have at home. And that adds to the exoticism. I think English kits need to up their game, frankly. And the kits in this part of the world just add to the allure, add to the appeal, and add to the whole mystique about it all. And looking back through Flamengo's past, some of the greats, and obviously the time that Stephen's alluding to in the 80s is the bit where they came to so many people's attention. And some of the great players they had, but they've reared their way back into attention in more recent years as well, and they've had so many highs in their time. It's a great club, and it's so evocative of Rio, of Brazil, of Carnival, of all that stuff. So it's a fantastic one to get into.
Sorry, muted. I was that excited, I forgot to unmute myself. Everyone seems so excited about this edition. And the final co-host, who is the man with a story for every occasion, I'm going to say, and I know what the answer is because we kind of chatted already, but I'm going to say you've either been, got a ticket, or a programme of this club. Mr. Yes. Paul McParlan.
Exactly, Stu, yeah. As we kind of discussed before we started recording the scene, I had the absolute pleasure to see Flamengo play Vasco da Gama on the 27th of July 1986. purely because I'd gone on a 6-week holiday to Brazil with one of my friends, and we landed at Rio at the start of the week. And the plan had been to move around to different places, but we loved Rio so much, we ended up staying there for about 3 weeks before we decided we better go somewhere else. And then I just noticed in the papers that that first Sunday we were there, Flamengo were due to play Vasco da Gama in, like, you know, a Rio State Championship derby game. So my friend's not a big football fan, so but I made a real thing that, you know, this is a deal breaker. We go to the match, so I'm going home. So make your decision now. So 11 in the morning, I was queuing outside the Maracana to make sure I got a ticket to get in. And the game didn't kick off till 8 o'clock, so I was being a bit ahead of myself there. But I wanted to make sure I got tickets. I was not going to miss this opportunity. Then came back to the hotel we were staying in, and then about 5 o'clock we set off for the game. And for some bizarre reason, the metro system in Rio didn't work on the Sundays at that time. So you think everyone's off and there's no public transport. Brilliant. The only way of getting to the ground was to get a bus there. So you got a bus in the centre of Rio, bus out against the Maracana. And obviously, for anyone of my generation or any football generation, the Maracana is just, wow, this is the place we want to be. The massive disappointment was Zico wasn't playing. He was injured for that game. So that took a bit of a gloss off it. But nevertheless, walking to the stadium is quite a strange experience, because we were the only ones there who had a white European look about us. Really, we really did stand out. And then we bought tickets for the cheapest terraces as well. And so it was like sort of, you know, standing on the cop with a Man United shirt. You know, it just wasn't a good look for us. So in my kind of hesitant sort of Brazilian Portuguese, because I could understand a bit of it, but I tried speaking to a few people. And then a few people thought, because I was saying the words, you know, like a Spanish-sounding accent, that I was Argentinian. So I went along with that for a bit. Yeah, I'd probably better be an Argentinian than being English here, you know. And we get a few glances from people. We just kind of stood by ourselves. Flamengo went 1-0 in the first half. Vasco got back to win, to lead 2-1 the second half. And I just remember seeing all the Vasco da Gama flags doing the underground, all waving, the noise they were making, because we couldn't really see the Flamengo support because we were standing with them. Flamengo came back on 1-3-2. So by the time the third goal went in, we were getting hugged and kissed by everyone around us, you know. And all we heard was each other, "Il campeão, il campeão." And we just got to join them, bounce them down the terraces with them. And suddenly we were one of them. We were okay. And as we came out of the ground, I went to get the bus back. Now, the bus going there had been quite civilised because we got there dead early. Of course, on the way out, you've got like 60,000 fans all heading for the same buses. And I've never had a bus journey like it. So we were nowhere near the queue. The buses were pulling away and people were just pulling onto the bus. And we hung on to the back of the bus, holding one person's hand who was on the roof. We're all the hands on the back of the bar of the bus. And we're riding through the centre of the thing. I've never, ever got a chance for a football match like this again in my life. This is absolutely superb. And all the buses rocking, singing, banging on the roofs, a chant all the way back to the centre. So it was just an absolutely fantastic experience. So because of that, you know, when this opportunity came to write about Flamengo, I couldn't wait to do so. And I kind of remember the first day we arrived at the hotel, and I asked the hotel, look, we're here, what's the team to support? And we're in a district called Gloria, which is quite near to the Maracana stage. And the guy said, well, if you want to walk the streets safely at night, put a Flamengo top on. So that's what we did.
Stephen and Aidan, I don't need you for the rest of the podcast. You can get yourselves off if you want.
Yeah, can't beat that.
I'm going to grab the popcorn now and just start from
Josh. Brilliant. And you see, Paul, that you are just the man for a story for every occasion.
And as you said, Stu, sadly, I have kept the tickets from that game all those years. But more sadly, there was no programme available. There really wasn't. So I have the tickets, but I don't have a programme.
Okay. Brilliant. I don't know how we're going to top that. I suppose I should talk about the magazine at some point. At the time of recording, the magazine is now out for up for sale. So again, don't miss the opportunity to purchase. We were chatting beforehand. What was the best way or the best advice to give you? And essentially, already the stocks are running low. So the second you hear this, pause it after Paul's story because you want to know how that ends. Pause it. And then go and order it, and then come back to listen to the rest of us tell our dull stories about how we've never been to watch Flamengo play. But at the time of recording, the magazine is still there. It's also in partnership with the Battle of the Tens, which is 10 articles, all of which have been split in half. Maverick players that are pitched against other Maverick players in a sort of, I want to say a write-off is what I think we'll call it, but that probably has the wrong connotation. But it's arguments for and against number 10s, great number 10s that have played through the history of the game. So it's a breathless start to this podcast. So the articles that are in there, we'll go through them quickly. So the first one is the day Paul McParland went to Flamengo and never really came back. It's not. It didn't make it. The first article is Leonidas da Silva, the Maverick who popularised the bicycle kick, Junior and Leandro, a reimagining of the fullback role, 1981 when Flamengo ruled the world by Stephen. The timeless genius of Zico by Paul, who nearly met him. Fla-Flu, Brazil's biggest club game by James Sweeney. 1987 and the title that never was by Luke Ginnell. When Romario returned to Rio at his peak by Aidan, which we'll all definitely want to hear about after the three of us have chatted about more or less the same subject. The final fling of Adriano by Josh. Our pet, how Dejan Petkovic conquered the Maracanã. The wild ride of Ronaldinho's Brazilian return by Will. The second coming of Gabigol by Chris. 2019 and the football of a generation by Luke. And it does have an absolutely wonderful cover, if you've not seen it yet on social media, by the Arsenal manager, George Graham. No, it's not. It's by the really talented, artist, George Graham, not the Arsenal manager at all. So, guys, we've finally got to the podcast. So much to talk about. I was going to kick off with what we all think about Flamengo, and I think we still will, before we launch into your guys' articles and what we've got in the magazine coming up. So I'll start with you. I'll start with you, Aidan, on this one. You can have first dib at this. Flamengo as a club, what do they mean to you?
Okay. Oh, no, alluded to it a little bit in the intro about the great colours and the sort of mystique and allure. And that a lot comes from what Stephen will talk about, I guess, from the Intercontinental Cup from the early 80s against Liverpool. And that's when they came into my consciousness. So from then, obviously, I think I was probably slightly too young to really appreciate it at the time, but I've read about it and seen about it and heard about it so much that I kind of think I did know about it at the time, if you know what I mean. And from then, that's always fixed the impression of Flamengo as the biggest club in Brazil. And nothing I've discovered since has changed that view in any way, shape, or form. If anything, it's, well, obviously it has cemented it further. It's the more you sort of discover about Brazilian football and Rio football, because it's very state or city specific in so many cases in Brazil. It's quite a complex setup. At least it certainly was more so in the past. And now they have a national championship alongside the state ones. It gets a little more regular in some ways, but there's so many clubs in Rio once you start to delve into it. And yet, for all the huge support you see for these others, for Vasco that Paul's mentioned, for Fluminense that we talk about in the rivalry, Botafogo, and various other ones smaller than them, Flamengo dwarfs them all, massively so. And the greater appreciation you get for that is just in how they pervade Rio life, it seems, everywhere. Paul's talking there about, you know, this is the shirt to wear if you want to survive on the streets around here. But I think that would probably apply in almost every area of Rio, other than those specifically right next to some of these other clubs. Or in Fluminense's case, probably if you're a certain class of the Rio society. So it's all-encompassing as a club in the city that seems to represent Brazil at its most world recognizable. And everything about the red and black shirt is what symbolizes Brazilian club football to me. The only club I can say stands out in my mind to a similar way in Brazil would be Corinthians, and that harks back to the same era because it's people in the early 80s that fixed these narratives in my mind. So in Corinthians' case, that's Socrates and his elegant play. Flamengo's case, it's Zico, who we've already mentioned there. Obviously, someone who's had a huge impact on you, Stu, and your consciousness, but equally for those of us of similar age, it's, you know, peak time for us to, I don't know, absorb the influences and get caught up in it all. And that's what Flamengo is. It's Zico, it's exoticism, it's flair, it's just the all-encompassing passion of Brazilian sport, of Brazilian football and of Rio football. And as much as the bright yellow and blue of the national team is, you know, that you think of Brazil, that's what you think of. But if you think of domestic Brazil, you think of red and black, you think of Flamengo, and you think of people like Zico back in the day, where the top Brazilian players played in Brazil. And we'll come on to it with my article, but it's very rare, of course, these days that top players play in Brazil, despite all the talent they've produced. But Flamengo, it's associated with that in my mind because of those days. And they still get a little bit of it now from time to time to shove them back into our recognition again. And that's it. The world of football is all the better for it. Clubs like Flamengo should remain in our consciousness because it is absolute behemoth of world football. And Brazilian football, and I guess world economics rule them out of being one of the top clubs in the world now, sadly, but in terms of status, they certainly are. They're right up there with the greats of Argentinian football, but also the greats of European football.
You're on fire tonight, guys. I've got to say that the Flamengo magazine seems to have brought out the best in everybody. Stephen, Aidan mentions a great point there, you know, looking at comparisons and how, and Paul mentioned it as well in his opening bit about how Flamengo just sort of permeate all of Rio and almost all of Brazil. And then, you know, you could argue all of South American football, perhaps along with Boca and maybe River Plate. In terms of England, you know, is there really a club that can compare to Flamengo, or is this the beauty of South American football that the passion allows the club to completely, or allow the clubs to completely dominate whole aspects of society?
I don't think there's anyone comparable. You know, there's no one you can compare in English football because I'm not saying Brazilian football isn't partisan, because of course it is. But, you know, we did a podcast, and I feel awful for forgetting the name of the guest now, when Stu, your My Side series, and we did exactly this Flamengo side and that iconic year of 81, and how we were told about how, you know, that particular Flamengo side kind of like broke down barriers. You know, even the most partisan of supporters of other teams, you know, hold them up as the benchmark for all club sides in Brazil. You know, comparable only. You know, only rivaled by the Santos of Pelé. You know, the two sides in Brazilian football that are, you know, eulogised over by supporters of other clubs as well. You know, even whether that's begrudgingly, you know, some flowingly, you know, that and that's the thing. And we don't tend to have that in English football, because although we've got storied clubs, you know, people are just too stubborn in the... You know, they're entrenched and they can't possibly give any quarter. You know, I suppose kind of like certain clubs across Europe that are possibly comparable. You know, some like a Benfica maybe. Might tip. Ajax are probably the only one that you could probably truly say in European football. You know, say that in Rotterdam, well, you know, we'll get a different answer. But everywhere else apart from Rotterdam, you know, it will tend to be a case of, yes, Ajax, you know, because they just have absolutely everything about them. You know, it's why they were one of the first club additions that we ever did, you know. But it's again, like Aidan said, it's the kit, it's the style of football, it's the verve, it's the aura around the club. And in a way, Flamengo are the South American Ajax in that respect, or certainly the Brazilian Ajax in that respect. And they do garner this respect, you know, from supporters of other teams, which is just so, so rare. But, you know, there isn't a comparable team in English, in British football in terms, because, you know, there are most successful sides. You're either kind of like hot or cold on them. You know, there tends to be, you know, a double-sided coin to them. You know, they will garner respect from other supporters, but, you know, for every supporter that will say, I admire and I enjoy that football team, there's probably five or six, you know, 10 or even that will turn around and say, this is why I can't admire that team or be seen to admire that team.
Okay, Paul. So Gary's not here. So you've got your copping for the question. Okay. So as Stephen was chatting there and as Aidan was chatting as well, and a question popped in my head.
Oh, no.
What do you think are, and I suppose Stephen's mentioned a couple of them, but what to you are the ingredients that make up a club like Flamengo? What is it that goes into the recipe, if you like, that results in this sort of product that is Flamengo? You're welcome, by the way.
It's just a lucky dip question, isn't it? Right. Okay. So, off the top of my head, well, I think that there's a number of factors, isn't there? I think it's important that the team is based. If it gives some general guidelines and sort of timing how they fare to Flamengo. One, I always think it's important that a team plays in one of the major cities of a country. So straight away there, you've got they're in Rio de Janeiro, second largest city in Brazil. So you've got that for the start. Secondly, they play in an iconic stadium. But the Maracanã is the most, as I said at the start, it's probably the most iconic stadium in South America, you know, far beyond Brazil as well. Thirdly, you know, it's got to have nationwide support across the country, which I think that Flamengo, as of all the Brazilian teams, actually attracts more support as well from outside of Rio de Janeiro than the rival teams like the Fluminense, Botafogo, Vasco da Gama. So they're kind of some of the regions there. Add to that footballing success, they won the Intercontinental Cup. And if you also factor in with that, which Aidan touched upon there, the legion of well-known players who play for the club as well, combined with an iconic kit, you kind of put all those into a melting pot and you get the ingredients for what is a team that catches people's attention from outside their home city, from outside their home country and across the globe as well. I think Flamengo tick all the boxes for that in terms of worldwide marketing appeal. And, you know, from a purely selfish point of view, I mean, if you look at the... There's some kind of parallels as well with history of English football as well, because when you think originally Flamengo came about because of a dispute with Fluminense and a group of players left Fluminense and set up Flamengo, you can see there's parallels as the Everton-Liverpool thing where Everton left Anfield after a dispute with the owners and the owner then set up a new club on what was left at Anfield. So there's some similarities there as well. So I think it says that. And I also just love the fact that, you know, South American clubs have great names, don't they? You know, there's no question about that. And I love the fact as well that Flamengo's full name reflects the fact they were started from a rowing club. You just wouldn't get that in the UK, a team that has a rowing club added to its name. So there's all sorts of different factors there that make Flamengo quite unique in Rio, but also make them quite unique across the globe as well. So, there's a number of factors, and I just think there's there's kind of an iconic appeal. And also, it's the name, isn't it? I mean, without being nationalistic here, Brazilian club names sound so much better than German club names. I'm sorry, but Flamengo sounds so much better than Mönchengladbach, doesn't it? It just rolls off the tongue better. So there's kind of, there's something about the Latin Romance languages that add to sort of the image and glamour of a team as well. So I've thrown all those in together. I think you come up with some reasons why Flamengo has a kind of global appeal, and argue that it's one of the few teams in Brazil that, I know Steve referenced Santos before, because certainly in the 60s and 70s, Santos were the Brazilian team everyone heard of purely because Pelé played for them. But I think since then, particularly with Zico, which we'll talk about later, I think Flamengo is the one team in Brazil that transcends the boundaries of the country.
Nicely played, by the way. Great answer. I have actually written down all your ingredients that go into it. Should I ever decide to make my own super club? Or, I've not had a chance to speak to Aidan yet about what's happened to Newcastle United. So I've made some notes for you about what it takes to become a super club.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a pod with you, Stu, if there wasn't a little dig at Newcastle. It's good.
Well, it makes me feel better. It just makes me feel better. I am sorry.
It's all right now. Any attention is better than none.
No such thing as bad press. Okay, so looking through the magazine, we've listed the articles, and as always, you know, it's a great collection of writers, it's a great collection of stories, it's the images, it's the artwork, you know, even from the front cover. And as you guys have all alluded to so far, you know, it's the kits, it's the fans, it's the stadium, it's the backdrop. You know, this whole magazine is so vibrant. But it's interesting to note, I was just counting through the articles there, and there are 9 players discussed amongst these articles. There are very few articles that don't focus on a particular player, which I guess you can look at it one or two ways. One, either that there's not many stories around Flamengo, which there actually is, or there is just that rich depth and history of players that have played for the club that have gone on to dominate the narrative. So what I thought we'd do is I thought we'll start with an article that doesn't actually relate to a player in particular, but what it does do is set the scene for probably one quarter of the whole magazine. Stephen, you've written about 1981. It's certainly for our generation. It's an iconic time. It's where, like you said at the beginning, it's where the club come into our conscience. It's where the players come into our conscience. It's where the players that will arrive in Spain a year later at the World Cup come into our conscience. It seems, again, you know, we talk about lines in the sand, but this Flamengo side, you know, that season, that campaign, that Intercontinental Cup, that Liverpool side just seems to be a line in the sand where we, or certainly myself, seem to take more notice of Brazilian club football.
Yeah, Brazilian club football, South American football, and they become the watchword of, you know, everything we kind of, you know, have come to know Brazil to be via their national team. You know, they were this projection of, you know, the Brazilian national team at club level. You know, yet, you know, I think it's about 4 players that go to that 1982 World Cup, which is an absolutely amazing thing, really. You know, I think all but one of the Libertadores winning side, the Intercontinental Cup winning side, were internationals. But it just goes to show the talent that Telly Santana had at his disposal in 1982, that he could just pick and choose, you know, whichever ones he wanted. You know, he could have taken that entire Flamengo side with him, you know, which would have been a very kind of a Lobanovsky type of thing to do with regards to Dinamo Kiev. You know, it would have been a simple answer, but, you know, nope, he didn't do that. He just, you know, I don't know, took the cream as he saw it. You know, absolutely amazing, startling side that just, I don't know, they set every precedence to what I have come to expect from Brazilian clubs, South American clubs. You know, we've been lucky enough to do those podcast series of the South American files with Dr. Pete, and you know we've come to draw up the, you know, the stereotypical cartoon characters and everything involved with them. You know, the villains, the heroes, and that was the thing about this Brazil side, and you know there was never any villains. They were just an entire team of heroes, you know, as far as I was concerned. You know, it can't possibly be in the case, but that romanticised version was that everything that Flamengo did was just for the purity of the game, you know, and it would be a very rose-tinted spectacles version of that. But, you know, some of the football that they produced was just astronomically good. And, you know, 1981 had absolutely everything, you know, to win the Carioca, to win the Libertadores, and then to pick apart my team, Liverpool, you know, and for me to wear that as a badge of honour for the last 40 years as well, because, you know, this is akin to, you know, I always say that when Scotland were picked apart at the 82 World Cup, you know, that they were glorious by association in that game. You know, there's Scotland, you know, glow within that game, and kind of Liverpool glow within that game of being taken apart by Flamengo. It is a privilege to be taken apart by a team like that sometimes, you know, and a team is just that good that you just kind of like have to, there's an artistry to it. But within that as well, that there's that darkness to that side in that year as well. and the loss of Claudio Coutinho, you know, who had done so much to put the building blocks of that side into place. And he died just 4 days after the Libertadores was won, you know, in tragic circumstances. You know, and one of the last people to see him alive was Junior. You know, it's a startling thing, really. Yeah, this amazing success. Yet the final flourish of it is done almost in tribute to him as well.
It's a really poignant, like you say, part to the story and a poignant moment. Within your article, obviously, we don't get a chance to read each other's articles. We just get to read them as soon as the magazine arrives. But I just need you to prepare me. I know your article's called 1981. And I know that sometimes you write about the previous 20 years and the future 20 years that come from the period of time that you're writing about. So am I going to need to set aside a full evening for your article, or does it pretty much condense down into that single season?
There's a little bit of flexibility in there. You know, it's a bit like sitting down at the football and kind of like stretching your legs a bit and making sure the people next to you get that, you know, this is my space and don't crowd me out too much. It's that type of thing. You know, it's kind of like turning around and scowling at the person who's kicking the back of your seat. It's that type of thing. So yeah, there's a little bit of bending of the rules again, but we're not talking Valencia bending of the rules here, where it went from kind of like a 3-year article that stretched to 2 decades. No.
Okay, that's good to know, but I just need to know how many drinks I would need to get through that article.
On the Valencia scale, of a 1 to 10, you're looking at about a 6.8.
Okay, so is this? I feel like we've just invented a new scale for magazine, like the Richter scale, yeah, but we've now just call it the Valencia scale.
Yeah, the Valencia scale. Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. I'll come to you next, Paul, and this Flamengo side that Stephen's written about, and this is not an age question. It's going to sound like one, but it's not. for yourself, you know, you'll have. Maybe not. Well, I imagine you definitely will have, to be fair. Seeing other South American sides play, you know, you would be more aware than we would at our age at that time, is the point I'm trying to get across in terms of South American players. When you saw that Flamengo side, you know, were you as blown away as we were sort of as kids, and obviously as Stephen was as a passionate Liverpool fan? Or was it something that you sort of knew that the continent was capable of, that you knew that those sides were capable of producing teams like that?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both, Stuart. I mean, obviously, from a purely selfish parochial point of view, as never to find ourselves who delighted the Flamengo beat Liverpool, because the thought of Liverpool being world champions in 1981 after winning the European Cup as well would have really been a lot to bear, I tell you. So, yeah. But I think as well, The Toyota Cup in 1981, which was kind of, you know, a reconfiguration of the Intercontinental Cup. So we'd had some experience South American sides via the Intercontinental Cup, which, you know, was either cup and highlights or sometimes a live package. And kind of the reputation we had of South American teams then was kind of dominated by the Argentinians, like say Estudiantes and Racing Club, who kind of kicked them, you know, and actually brawled their way to winning trophies. And of course, because that South American football became a bit tainted, particularly when it came to like the mid-70s, when like, so I actually used to participate in the Intercontinental Cup. So to some extent, to see a Brazilian team come through and then play with all the flair and style that you kind of, as a kid, you'd always grown up associating with Brazilian football, was just really, really encouraging to see. So, yes, I mean, there was a huge sense of expectation because, you know, if you're a fan of Brazilian football now, you can probably watch all the games live on various satellite channels. You can get wall-to-wall coverage. But, of course, you know, as we all know from growing up in that era, you know, you only got little tasters of these club sides from different continents, you know, particularly South American ones. So, and your main contact with sort of Brazilian football was via the national team. So to get a chance to see Flamengo with some of the players who graced the World Cup in 82, you know, was quite a treat for, you know, for us watching back in the UK. So yeah, I mean, it certainly lived up to expectations. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, I think even more so in the 70s and 80s, the English press were kind of in love with Brazilian football. It was just a standard by which, you know, other countries would judge. But that tends to be on the international scale. Brazilian club football didn't get anything like the coverage it gets now. I mean, I think if you look back at World Soccer magazines from the 70s and 80s, you know, Brazilian football gets about one page, two columns, if that, if you're lucky. Whereas the football in Belgium, Holland, Germany is getting 3, 4, 5 pages coverage in every monthly edition. So my only insight into Flamengo was reading World Soccer at that time. And even their coverage was extremely limited as well. So, but it did create the expectation because you just knew if a Brazilian team was playing in the World Club Championship final against Liverpool, it was going to be some game. And given how strong Liverpool were at that time, considering how dominant, what a dominant force in football they were, then you knew it was going to have to be take a team of supreme, sublime skill to overcome them. And certainly, no, without a doubt, Flamengo lived up to those expectations.
So yeah, I'd just throw in there.
Yeah,
as well,
of course.
Is the, you know, that game takes place like, was it early to mid December 81, and Brazil had come to England and played at Wembley against England in the May, you know, and really kind of like taking the ball. This was a game that took place 2 days before the FA Cup final replay, played on the Tuesday night, and the FA Cup final replay was on the Thursday, and this was a game where, you know, Zico scores this wonderful winning goal, and it's like set up by, I think Leandro plays a big part in the build up to it. And again, you know, so you've had this taster of some of these players, these Flamengo players, and then here they are again. You know, so twice in a short blast, relatively short blast, you know, with 6 month span. Bearing in mind just how much football wasn't on television at that point in time, to be able to have seen that Brazilian side, you know, take England apart, you know, 1-0, but give them a footballing lesson, and then Flamengo to go up against Liverpool. You know, this was an unprecedented stretch of time, and just indicative how good Brazilian football was at that point in time, and how prominent Flamengo were.
Sort of coming to you, Aidan, and carrying on with what Stephen and Paul have said there about Flamengo, and you know, what Brazilian football was at that time. But that sort of 1981 side, to me, they're what I would call a generational fantasy side. You know, maybe look at, maybe Ajax would be classed as that, maybe Guardiola's Barcelona. You know, is that how you, you know, do you hold them in that high esteem, as probably I do, you might not. But, you know, to me, they are that Flamengo side, that, you know, that period of time, they were just, you know, like say a once in a generation type side.
I think it's tied up so closely with the Brazil of 82. And as Stephen's saying there, you know, 1981, they came to England, they toured Germany and France, I think it was in the stint of about a week, and beat all three. Several of the key players were from Flamengo, and you associate them together, I think you lump them together as one in your mind. So the joy that Brazil team brought, as you well know, Stu, you know, the fantasy,
right.
Yes,
yeah.
That team. it's for all that it wasn't all from Flamengo, of course, there were representatives from several clubs, key players as well. But I think because that was so glorious, to then, we're talking about young impressionable minds here when we're talking about how I perceive it. And therefore, you just link the two together because you've seen Flamengo, you've seen Zico, and you've seen them taking apart a team that was so dominant in England and Europe at that time. You're talking of generational teams. Well, Liverpool around that time were a generational team, and they'd just been ripped apart. Now, so what does that say about the team that did that? They have to be pretty special to do so. So, yes, to some extent, I think you can lump them in that kind of category. You mentioned Ajax, so you could also say Bayern before, and then Liverpool running on after that, probably, and then the more recent examples as well. The way they don't quite fit it so well is because we're less aware of what came after. So we don't necessarily know, unless you've studied it, it didn't really enter our consciousness whether they won a couple of Libertadores 3 years in a row or anything like that to make it comparable achievement.
If Stephen had used the Valencia scale, we'd have known.
Yes, exactly. So we really should know. Maybe we will know when we're losing. But I think that's instead of that, though, we associate it together with the Brazilian national team success. And sure, that is an amalgam of several teams. But in a young kid's consciousness, it's Brazilian football on top and there's Zico. They both have that. And therefore, it kind of one runs into the other. And certainly did to my mind. And it certainly sort of stays that way of that era of Brazilian football. The success of Flamengo goes hand in hand with the almost success of Brazil.
It was obviously the sort of the overarching figure of this. This entire magazine was going to be Zico. Paul, you got the plum ticket you got the plum ticket. I won't dress it up any other way. One, I suppose, you know, a bit about your article and what it's about. But second of all, did you feel pressure, but obviously this was going to be the article, or this is going to be the article that most people are going to, certainly it'll be the first article I go to, in terms of wanting to know, purely obviously because of my interest in the player. But did you feel pressure that probably in more than most magazines that this was going to be the go-to article?
Unquestionably,
or do you just feel it now?
Feels it now, Stu. Probably never did.
No. I think it's a bit of both, Stu, because obviously, I mean, this writing this has been quite unique for me because I knew straight away I was under pressure from yourself because your knowledge of Zico and that Brazilian team is so immense. I thought, if I make one slip here, if I make one mistake, if I get one bit of research wrong, he's going to come at me. He's really going to have a go at me here. So I felt immense pressure just from you alone, and not to mention the rest of the team.
No pressure here, Paul. But I wrote about Zico twice as well for these Football Times, so I'm coming for you as well if you've got this one. Yeah.
And I did reference one of your articles as well, Stephen. It was really useful to me. And it's on a par of having to write about Pelé, isn't it? You know, and as you all know yourselves, when you've written about iconic club players, it's really difficult sometimes to present something new, to present a different angle, to not just churn out something that most people know. So you have to do lots of research as well. You have to, you know, to explore every possible lead, every possible link, every possible quotation to try and give you some insight that you can't get from the normal sources. And I always like to focus on players, you know, what they're like as kids, you know, kind of what their background was. And one of the, you know, things always intrigued me about Zico was his background was quite dissimilar to lots of Brazilian footballers who came through in the 60s, 70s and 80s. Because, you know, by Brazilian standards, he was quite middle class. By Brazilian standards, he was from a white European background. So his kind of upbringing, he wasn't in the shanty towns, he wasn't in the favelas. So his background was not the one that is associated with Brazilian football particularly. And then you look at his dad. I mean, Zico's dad was 51 when Zico was born. Now that's quite an old age these days, you know, for parents. So he was one of six siblings. He had a rival brother in Edu, who went to play for America in Rio. I think he's the second ever highest goal scorer. So there's kind of some sibling rivalry there as well, which can either work for you or can work against you. And then the one thing that kind of, you know, he was always having to do, another thing that made a difference as well was he wasn't a teenage prodigy like Pelé or Ronaldo or someone. He didn't actually break through into Flamengo's first team until he was 20. And so his kind of route to the top was actually quite slow compared to, you know, some Brazilian superstars. Then you get tagged with the name the White Pelé, and suddenly the pressure's absolutely ramped up once that topic is associated with you. Similar to Diego Maradona, you know, he had it looked as though once his physique might count against him, and he came through kind of the futsal route rather than the traditional 11-side football on the pitch route. And then linked to that, like Maradona, he had growth hormones, he had injections to improve his size and physique. So he went from being about 4'10" to 5'4", 5'5". So, you know, it wasn't all plain sailing for him. So he did a quite a difficult route to make it to the top. And then there were other factors as well, you know. When he was training with Flamengo, he trained with Flamengo in the morning and went to school in the afternoon. And Flamengo didn't provide a lunch at the end of the morning training session. So when Zico's dad found out his son was going to school hungry, he threatened to take Zico away from Flamengo and put him with America instead of where his brother was, at which point Flamengo realised, well, for the price of a dinner, maybe we should offer that dinner to keep this kid here. And that's what they did. And it's quite an interesting parallel as well, because Flamengo lost on the chance of getting Ronaldo because they refused to pay his bus fares to go training with them. So they missed out on somebody there, and you thought they might have learned from the Zico lesson. So, yeah,
couldn't he have just hung off the back of the bus like you, Paul?
Yeah, sadly, he was a better footballer than me, Ronaldo, so it turned out, you know. Yeah, I did struggle stuff on the beach of Rio, but the talent scouts just never raced it, you know. And I love research on all that sort of stuff. I mean, you go back to like the 1981 game that Stevens referenced in detail there. And of course, Zico won the Man of the Match Awards, unsurprisingly, and was presented with the Toyota Celica. And he's still got it now. 40 years later, he still drives that Toyota Celica around. He's had people trying to buy it off him, and he refuses to let it go. He almost says sometimes that's his best ever trophy in football. And then, look, linked to his successful Flamengo career, unlike Pele, he didn't have a successful World Cup career. You know, he's one of many footballers, and I totally identify with this, who suffered at the hands of an outrageous Clive Thomas refereeing decision in the 1978 World Cup when, you know, for some bizarre reason, Clive Thomas disallowed his head of goal against Sweden because he blew his whistle when the ball was in flight. I mean, type of thing that only Clive Thomas can do, isn't it? And his World Cup career, it didn't match his club career, which makes him completely distinct from Pelé in that respect. And he also comes across as being a really, really decent guy. The first team he ever played against for Flamengo when he was a youngster was a team called Everest. And when he found out in 2020, I think it was, that Everest were on the verge of going bankrupt, he stepped in to try and save the stadium and save the ground, because he had fond memories of that was the ground when he made his first ever game for Flamengo. When he was coming through the ranks at Flamengo, his best friend was someone called Gerardo Cleofado, who looked like he was going to be a better player than Zico at one stage. And a tragic story, he went for an operation to have his tonsils removed, and he died on the operating table. And that really affected him for the rest of his footballing career, knowing that, but a simple twist of fate, he might not have been the next brilliant superstar. His friend Geraldo might have been. So there's loads of little background stories that the more you researched about it, the more you thought, well, I might find something Stu doesn't know here. And that was kind of the thing that does keep me going all the way through writing the article. And then, of course, when he goes back to Flamengo at the end of his career is ended by a bone-crunching challenge that finishes it. I know he makes a comeback, he's never the same player. So his career doesn't finish on a high. It finishes with a degree of bitterness, and he's still suffering today with the consequences and legacy of that injury. But the main reason why I want to write about Zico is, as we all know at that time, every time you're at a football game in the 80s and you got a free kick, all you could hear was the cry, Zico, Zico, Zico. Every schoolboy playground, if you're playing or watch games, every time someone hits a long-distance shot, Zico, Zico. So he's one of the few players who becomes synonymous with a shot or a free kick, because his long-range shooting was just so mesmerising and just so powerful. And as you outline it in prolific detail, Stu, in your book about Brazil 1982 World Cup, there's just something about Zico. I mean, he might never have succeeded on the World Cup stage, but what memories did the guy leave us?
Brilliant. It can't not be a great article. And like I say, There's no doubt you've done it justice and beyond. For you, Stephen, you know, Zico the player, where do you put him in the pantheon of number 10s?
he's way up there with so many of the best. You know, he was the best player on the face of the planet for a while. People will point to kind of like Maradona, and yes, but you know, Maradona's blossoming, ultimate blossoming of being the best player in the world, didn't come as early as people will often peg it as being. You know, and in 1981, 1982, Zico was the real deal. He was the best player on the face of the planet. He was the best player on the face planet going to the 1982 World Cup. You know, he was, you know, this. I think the thing about Zico is that he had all the skills, he had all the attributes, you know, of the individual, you know, playmaker, fantasist, or whatever we want to describe him as. Yet he had that rare element for a player in his position, for that number 10, was that he was the ultimate team player as well. He was willing to do the scruffy things. It didn't always have to be the prettiest things. I always, you know, reference that goal against Argentina when the ball hits the underside of the crossbar. Who's the first player to the ball to get it over the line? It's Zico. You know, he worked incredibly hard. You know, he was kind of like the complete number 10. You know, so many number 10s will have certain facets to them. Maybe they don't do the hard running. Maybe the others do the running. You know, do the bidding for them, you know, and they are there to unpick the lock and to have the outrageous skills and the most memorable piece of skill. But Zico had a little bit of absolutely everything, yet he still had the, you know, the wonderment of the individual to go alongside him.
You're right. The work ethic was absolutely incredible. His work ethic was incredible. For you, Aidan, I feel awkward asking all these questions because obviously my feelings towards him. But for you, Aidan, obviously, you know, that the lack of a World Cup medal, you know, we talk about Maradona. Maradona doesn't win the European Cup. You know, Zico does win, you know, the South American equivalent, but he doesn't win the World Cup. Does that impact his legacy? Or, you know, as the original question that I gave to Paul at the beginning, and, you know, what makes Flamengo such a all-pervasive super club? Does the fact that he plays such an integral part actually sort of accommodate that and allow him to get over that and not tarnish his legacy?
If he wasn't Brazilian, then possibly you think it wouldn't tarnish his legacy. There's so many great players who never get remotely close to winning a World Cup purely because of where they're from. You know, George Best never even played in a World Cup, yet is still one of the greatest players there's ever been. There's any number of players who, just by their accident of birth, may be the greatest on the planet but will never get a look in. Conversely, there's a load of rank average players who will win a World Cup just because they happen to be from the right place at the right time. Now, if you're Brazilian, though, those rules don't apply. If you're the best player in the world and you're Brazilian and you don't win a World Cup, it has to take something away. Now, it pains me to say it because, you know, teams that haven't won World Cup and the greats in it is something quite close to my heart. And Zico as a player, as Stephen was saying there in the playgrounds, oh, sorry, Paul was saying, everyone was shouting, Zico, Zico. I remember doing that. Doing anything great on the playground was you were being Zico. Occasionally people wanted to be Paolo Rossi, I'm afraid to say. But the majority of the people doing the great things wanted to be Zico. Anything great was Zico. The mere word, if you take it and change it from a name to be a word in its usage, just meant an amazing player and doing something amazing. That's what Zico meant. So his name is kind of, it transcended merely what he was achieving and just became a cultural thing in a way. And that can't have just been in this country. That will have been in so many places. But as I said, if you're a Brazilian great and don't win the World Cup in a country that expects to win the World Cup all the time, has won it more than anybody else, I think that must take him down a notch in terms of the Brazilian greats. Possibly how he's perceived within Brazil, how he's perceived by you and me, Stu, it probably doesn't make a damn difference because we think he's great anyway. And the romanticism of how it all went wrong and sticking to the ideals and so on, that elevates him in our mind. But possibly that's not how everybody sees it. And if you compare him to Ronaldo, the phenomenon of Ronaldo, who obviously did win a World Cup with Brazil, parent to Pele, who obviously won several World Cups with Brazil, compare him to Jairzinho and Tostão and Rivelino, these players, they've all been part of a magical World Cup win for Brazil. Zico hasn't. Does he therefore not quite sit on the same level in Brazilian perceptions? I argue that's possibly so.
Yeah, it makes me sad. I'm not going to lie. It does make it makes me sad too.
Because, as I say, for me, it doesn't make a jot of difference. Because
no, it doesn't.
And Stephen's quite right to say he was the very best player in the world at that time. So that counts for an awful lot. And that's what some of those people I've mentioned weren't. So they were overshadowed by others in the 1970 team. And yet they are names that we remember and they resonate through the decades still, because they were part of an iconic World Cup win. If Zico had won the World Cup in 1982, I think he would very much sit as one of the most recognisable names and talents of all time. And possibly because he didn't, he doesn't.
It's a great answer to the question. Like you say, I love the by virtue of birth and way. I think it's a great perspective and a great way to look at it. The article that I've written is about Junior and Leandro, which clearly was the all that was left for me after Paul had got in there first. We're not going to talk about that because I think we've dwelt on this subject quite a lot and has taken up nearly an hour, to be fair, of the podcast, which I thought it would, that and Paul's journey to the marathon now. But in terms of your article, Aidan, and this was something that I wasn't actually aware of, that he'd ever played that, whether that's my ignorance or whatever it is, I don't know. But you know, you talk about another Brazilian great, another iconic, let's call him an iconic Brazilian player, you know, Romario and what he brought and his personality and the type of player he was, you know. And you talk about him, you know, your article about going back to Rio, you know, at the peak of his powers. And like I say, it's not a story that I was greatly aware of, or that he'd actually gone there, and certainly not at the time that he went there.
No, you're right. It's not so well known about because, and this is part of the story, because he moved from Barcelona's dream team, Johan Cruyff's dream team, because he left there from, you know, one of the greats of European football who were possibly just past their peak, but had been at a big peak in the early 90s. And because he left to somewhere that was beyond our consciousness in some way, that, yes, it can be forgotten about. Now, yeah, I knew he'd gone there, but I didn't know the details of too much about what happened there or how it went or any of that. But for me, he's such an intriguing character. And we talked there about Brazilians who did or didn't win a World Cup. Now, Romario obviously was key to a World Cup success for Brazil. I still, despite that, I wouldn't put him on Zico's level as a player overall, but as a striker. He was, as Johan Cruyff described him, a genius of the goal area. He was clinical. He was lethal. And this is a time where we're talking only 6 or 7 months after he'd won the World Cup for Brazil in 1994. So towards the end of that year, he'd been back in Brazil, in Rio, and one of his regular sojourns back, this is the recurring theme, he kept getting pulled back to the city that he loved and felt the most at home in. Even whilst playing in Barcelona, he managed to wangle his way to go off back to Brazil for Christmas and New Year, for Carnival on occasion. And it was on one of these Christmas and New Year trips where he decided to announce that he was going to leave Barcelona. He was in negotiations with Flamengo. Now, it's a bizarre situation. It's even more bizarre when you consider that he was the reigning World Player of the Year. So we talked there about Zico being the best player in the world at the time. That's what Romario was in terms of that award, whether you consider that as being as clear-cut as Zico's standard in the early 80s is another matter. But he was the reigning World Player of the Year off the back of his performances in the World Cup, of course. So for a player of that stature, at a club of that stature, to just suddenly decide, well, I've had enough, aged 29, I've had enough of this the big clubs in the big leagues of Europe. I'm going back to Brazil. What a coup that was for a club like Flamengo, and what a coup for Brazilian football as well. And the Flamengo fans obviously probably couldn't believe their luck to have somebody of his astonishing abilities and astonishing finishing prowess to suddenly pitch up at their club. But more than that, and what really appeals to me, and this is why I wanted to write about him, because him as a character, as well as a player, I absolutely love a sort of arrogant maverick player. I don't see that as a negative in any way. That just adds to the appeal of people like Ronaldo. You need a little bit of the bad boy to liven things up sometimes. And he had this in spades. He was a real free spirit in the grandest tradition of untamed mavericks. And he really was. And this caused issues everywhere he went, as you'd imagine. He maintains the more he partied off the field, the better he played on it. You know, scoring in every sense, I think. One type of scoring enhanced the other, whichever way around you want to see that. And where better to live this lifestyle than Rio? And obviously, this is his home city as well. He was a Vasco fan as a boy, but this is his home city. And it always drew him back and always stayed with him, and he always felt most at home there. But if he's ever going to go partying anywhere, this is Rio where he wants to do it the most. So he had his problems with Flamengo as well. He was there for five years in total, although that was interrupted twice by disappearing back to Spain, to Valencia. He transferred there, and then Valencia changed coaches. This is where I've gone on the Stevens scale of going into other things. There's a little bit of what happened in Valencia in my article. Of he was there briefly, didn't go well, change of coach, got sent back to Flamengo on loan. The loan to Flamengo ran out and he had to go back to Valencia, hated it, and got a transfer back to Flamengo again. So in all, it was three stints, but they kind of all work as one. And he scored more than a goal a game across that whole time he was there, which is absolutely astonishing. Even, you know, you allow a little bit for the fact that some of that would be in the state championship against weaker teams. Not all of it is top league level, I suppose, if you look at it that way. But still, what an astonishing record that is. And for Flamengo fans, he was part of what is a sort of mystical forward line. So there was a young Savio, who would later go on to Real Madrid. And then there was Edmundo, who is another maverick character that appeals to me greatly because of all sorts of issues. Now, he and Romario had this love-hate relationship going on. You know, they couldn't stand each other one minute and loved each other the next. Romario was kind of instrumental in Edmundo coming to Flamengo, and despite all the issues they sometimes had. And together, those three became known to Flamengo fans as the Ataque dos Sonhos, which, as we all know, means the attack of dreams. I'm sure I didn't need to translate that for everybody there. But that's what they were to the Flamengo fans. And this is where the goals just kept raining in and raining in. Bebeto came along as well, another player who Romario had on-off relationships with, of how well things were between the two of them. But obviously, he was a key partner in the 1994 World Cup as well for Romario. But Flamengo as a team, despite all these goals and the pressure on Romario to deliver and him keeping delivering, it wasn't actually a great era for the club itself. They reached some finals, they won a few, lost a few, but overall, in terms of success in the National League and beyond, it didn't quite lead to what it possibly should have done. There was no consistency to the team, so he would partner Edmundo one week and Bebeto another, and that's not going to help anybody really. And eventually, it all went sour in the way you'd expect it to, which is he'd gone off on the lash, partying moments after, straight from the dressing room, more or less, moments after a humiliating defeat for the club in a state championship against one of those lowly teams I was talking about. And that wasn't a good look. And this was, I think, the final straw of a number of issues that he'd been causing them. But the thought I'm left with Romario, other than the fact that he always wanted to get drawn back, or he was always allowing himself to be drawn back to Rio. So him coming back to Flamengo and then eventually off to Vasco afterwards, that seemed appropriate. For it to happen at his peak is astonishing, but equally, I think, appropriate. But you think of him as a player, would he have been so good without the lifestyle that made him feel so comfortable? This isn't just somebody deciding that, you know, I don't care about the rules necessarily. I think this genuinely what he felt brought the best out of himself. Now, whether that you know, in physical state, it can't possibly have done. But in terms of his own state of mind, it did, I think. And would his career have kept blossoming had he not been able to return so frequently and eventually for long term back to the city he simply couldn't resist? And these are the sort of themes, I think, that come out with him and his quite remarkable time at Flamengo.
I mean, obviously, you know, it's going to be a wonderful ask. Like I say, it's not a story that I'm particularly au fait with. The question for you, Stephen, is who in the These Football Times team is the Romario of These Football Times? I'll get you, Danny, to answer that. We know it's Hayden. Do you think that, you know, his obstinance, you know, and Hayden makes a great point, the single-mindedness that is and was Romario, you know, do you think he was only one of a few handful of players who could almost make that what you would call a reverse move? You know, everybody was coming out of South America at that time to go play in Europe. And there he is, sort of bucking the trend and World Player of the Year, and this is what I'm going to go and do. There are not many players, or to me there are not many players, who have that strength of mind and almost bloody-minded obstinance to just go and do it and get away with it.
Yes, it does take a certain personality to do that, you know, a certain strength of personality, you know, a belligerence almost. And within that, you know, it comes as no surprise that he's moved into politics, you know. So, you know, he knows his mind, he knows what he wants, and he goes out and gets it. And that's exactly what he did with his, you know, return to Rio and, you know, his myriad spells with Flamengo. You know, he did that because he wanted to. It wasn't because the sponsors thought it was the best move for him. You know, it didn't smack of kind of like the best financial deal that he could have had on the table. You know, that's one of the great things about Romario, is that he played where he felt wanted, where he felt comfortable. You know, it's no surprise that, you know, some of his greatest footballs played in a Flamengo shirt. You know, it's no surprise that, you know, he had such respect for PSV Eindhoven. You know, that for certain players there are, I don't know, that there is just a certain type of landscape that they have to play on to be able to get the best out of themselves. And just as Aidan said there, you know, he almost like some players have to back themselves into a corner to be able to come out fighting. You know, and that's the best that they will be. You know, they've got to find that spot, and this was, and in a way it's backed into a corner, but it's a sweet spot. It's a sweet corner. You know, they can't fail to come out of these corners and fight and show themselves to be the legends that they are. And that was Romario. You know, and every time you see him interviewed, the person that Romario comes across as doesn't always match the player he was as well. You know, yet you know that it's always bubbling under the surface, that version of him is just never that far away. And I don't know, maybe with Flamengo, I don't know, you can point to PSV, you can point to Barcelona, you know, and just how fleeting his time with Barcelona is. You know, yeah, Flamengo, it's much more lasting. And yeah, that the complexities of those relationships with, you know, Edmundo, with Bebeto and so many others as well. It's that way that he would inspire players around him as well. You know, that every team that Romario played in, it's not just about him. You know, it's what revolves around him as well and what he inspires. Very different character to Zico, and saying that how hardworking Zico was and that he would garner that respect. It was almost, when it comes to Romario, it's almost like a degree of one-upmanship, and his teammates need to try and match him. you know, we spoke about the, you know, a certain kind of dance off at the start of this podcast. That's what football surrounding Romario was all about. You know, it's a dance off between some very skilled players and a great deal of one-upmanship on the go. And yeah, it's no surprise that version of Flamengo doesn't win the trophies that it probably should, because they will have undoubtedly lost focus on the bigger prize for the fun of it almost.
I'll come to you now, Paul, with a question we often ask about Aidan and his comparison to Romario. So, is Romario personality over performance, or is he performance over personality?
I suppose it depends on your viewpoints. On Maverick footballers, you can kind of take the view that, you know, would his performances have been better if his lifestyle had been more restrained? But you could also take the view that, you know, he needed those outlets to keep performing at that level. I mean, I fully support Aidan's, you know, concept of the football and Maverick. I think we've all grown up loving football and Mavericks in our time, you know, from George Best onwards. And I was kind of thinking when you were speaking, Aidan, about the about Romario going back to real world design, because he ended up playing for most of the clubs of Rio some stage his career, didn't he? He kind of finished off back at Vasco da Gama as well, you know, the club he supports. And I was trying to think of a comparison with Paul Gascoigne, and I was wondering, like, do you think Paul Gascoigne, if he'd been given the choice to go back to Newcastle every 2 or 3 years, might end up being a better, long-lasting player because he went back to an area where he was obviously very, very comfortable and very relaxed, and that could have given the impetus to then go back and progress his career elsewhere? Because I just look, no, as Steve's outlined there before, this is a player at the peak of his powers at Barcelona. He's won the World Cup in 1994. You know, he probably doesn't need the money anymore, and he's in a situation where you can probably say, I don't need the money, I can go and pick and choose who I want to play for, knowing that if it doesn't work out, someone's going to come back in for me, just purely on my goal scoring prowess and reputation alone. And as Stephen outlined there before as well, I mean, you know, with this chaos of lifestyle, you know, with his preference for spending a lot of time with members of the opposite sex and enjoying himself, you know, you can almost see that Boris Johnson modeled himself on him, can't you?
Well, my comparison with Aidan's gone right down the pan now. this magazine, it's everything we've talked about. It's all these stories. To me, it's a magazine that is just brim full of personality, I think, more than anything else. Like I say, probably vibrancy is, you know, is also one of a better word. And, you know, there's articles that, you know, we're an hour and 10 minutes into this podcast and we've only talked about three articles, but that's sort of the, I guess, the power of the club. And it's something that we go back to. I think you've mentioned it before, Stephen. Some clubs just engender a love and a non-bias, unless you're obviously another Rio side. You can't help but love these clubs, and, you know, fans of football right around the world love these clubs. I'm not saying it's why we write about them, but not only do they have rich history and stories and, you know, and great players, but there's just this affinity that football fans just buy into.
Yeah, because they just tick a lot of boxes. And, you know, when you're talking about Zico, Romario being there, Ronaldinho, Adriano, you know, and more of the offbeat stories as well, and you know, Petkovic, you know, that we've not even got to. I'm going to be, you know, really looking for, you know, that was one of the articles, because every time that Omar sends out the list of articles and what he, you know, what he's open to get in and stuff like that, I'll usually just kind of like say, yeah, you know, I'll rattle off half a dozen that I'd be more than happy to write and say, pick any of those and I'll do it. And that was one that I threw in there as well that I'd have been happy to have written. But, you know, 81 in bold was the way that I went. But they're just this, I don't know, storied club. And what it is, it comes down to kind of like the joy of football, you know, because it's that inner child as well. So when we're talking about an Ajax and we're saying it's Cruyff, it's Rep, it's, you know, all of these iconic footballs, it's Van Basten, you know, whatever it is, there's someone that, you know, we go back to like kicking the ball around, and it's the 82 World Cup, and we all want to be Zico. And Aidan's right. Some of us, you know, will be in Paolo Rossi. You know, it'll be a Platini, it'll be a Boniek, it'll be whoever it is. You know, every generation will have a version of that. And, you know, Will would have kicked the ball around wanting to be Ronaldinho or, you know, whoever it is. So it does, it stretches back across the generations. So these teams that are just so inherent for having these types of players and a certain brand of football that is based around, you know, the love of the ball and caressing the ball and making magical things happen with it. You know, they just engender kind of like they reawaken the inner child in a way. And that's what we're all looking for football, is that, you know, it's making the inner child, you know, happy.
It is. And it's, I am going to ask you, because I started it last time on the last magazine, where I'm going to ask you for your recommended article read. Now, if everybody just picks the Zico one, we're going to start again. So you might just have to have a second choice, all of you. But before, Aidan, just a quick question I want to ask you. You know, like I say, this, you know, right from the front cover, this magazine seems to have almost a unique feel. We've done Boca, we've done River Plate, which are also two South American clubs. But does this magazine and its content have a different feel to the Argentinian clubs that we've done?
I think it has to, because I think in so many people's minds, Brazilian football, whether this is right or wrong, is far more joyous than Argentinian football. I think that's a sort of deep-seated stereotype that is probably wholly based in nothing whatsoever.
I think all our Argentinian listeners have just, well, they probably weren't listening in the first place, to be fair. No, you're right.
But I think there's a deep-rooted thing, possibly in the English psyche anyway, that Brazilian football is good, Argentinian football is bad. And I don't mean quality bad, I mean stylistically bad. It's more cynical. We kind of think of Brazil as more joyous. That's complete rubbish, because Brazilian football is just as cynical as the rest. And Argentinian football can be just as joyous as the rest. But I think that's what contributes to the feel of a magazine like this. So it's not just, as we talked about, the glorious colour scheme and the iconic kits and the iconic players. I think it's also because it's Brazil. Now, this, I know that we've had further back in the past a sort of Brazil-focused magazine more in its entirety, but it's the first club issue we've gone back to South America for, and the first one we've done in Brazil. We've done two Argentinian ones so far, and they did have a different tone. And I just think that's what it is. It's the extra mystique and allure of what we perceive as a more joyous style of football. And maybe that's a generational thing, and maybe that's me speaking as somebody like yourself and Stephen, who grew up with Brazilian football being like that. It represented everything, as Stephen said, that the wide-eyed child appreciates in football, the sort of joy and appreciation that a child can give that cynics like us probably couldn't. If something like similar came along now, we'd probably all rail on about how it wasn't as good as such and such in the past. Whereas at that time, it was just everything that was perfect about football. And I think a magazine like this just tugs on that particular thought and feeling in minds of people like us, and hopefully of many more people as well. Because I think, as ever, there's so many great tales that can be told and are told in the magazine. But I think it has an extra appeal because of that allure of Brazil, the Brazilian football, the exoticism, and its most iconic club.
Brilliant. Before I ask you for your recommendations, I feel like we should end the podcast with where we started, and that's Paul's journey to the marathon. So obviously Zico wasn't there, Paul. Can you name drop any players that you did see that of note in that game?
Sadly, there weren't any players in Newell whatsoever, but there are some clips of the game on YouTube which I was stunned to find the other week when I was trying to remind myself of the experience as well. I remember talking to people at the time, and there was chatting to a New Zealand guy who was staying in our hotel, and he'd come over when the World Cup was being shown, the 86 World Cup. And he was describing, and he wasn't a football fan, this guy. He was describing what it was like to watch the penalty shootout with France in the bars in Rio. And he said, when Zico stepped up to take his penalty, and then the silence had just descended on the city when Zico missed his penalty. And then kind of the cheers when Platini missed his penalty as well, in contrast. I'd say he'd never been in an atmosphere like it, where it went from joy to happiness to sadness to despair, all within a cycle of about 2 to 3 minutes. And this guy wasn't a football fan particularly, but he said the whole city that evening was just, it was like there was a state funeral being held. So he'd never seen Rio so quiet and so full of despair for what was such a fun-loving city. And it was just really dead interesting to get his insights on what that whole experience had been like. And strange to admit, I tried to actually buy a Brazil shirt when I was there, but none of the shops were selling them because the 86 World Cup to them just was not something they wanted souvenirs of as well. So it was quite a strange experience about the whole thing. But I mean, Justin says of the match with the Maracanã, it is undoubtedly one of the most fabulous football experiences of my life. And that bus ride, even now, it's just something I could never, ever hope to experience again in my life. And, just savor every minute of it. And, the stage was almost a bit of a disappointment because inside the terraces were crumbling, the crash bandies were falling apart, but the atmosphere was just great. And one of the things that really struck me about Rio was that the population was just so young compared to, the average age in the UK at the time. The crowd was full of young fans all watching the game. And one thing that kind of came up, slightly shocking, was I'd always read all the stuff about, all the footballers. You go on the beaches of Rio and you see all these potential new Pelés and Zicos coming through. It was nothing like that at all. The guys on the beaches were guys in the 40s and 50s with beer bellies kicking the ball around. There was no Samba football on the beaches. But one day we got the tram into the Santa Teresa district of Rio, and you look down the side, she's there with the favelas. Where the favelas were, I know you can see where goals marked on the walls, kids kicking a ball around, kids practicing kicking a ball against the wall. That was where you could see that's where the next generation of football is going to come from, not from the beaches of Rio. Because for those sorts of kids, they couldn't actually afford to get the tram into the Rio Centre to get to the beach to play football there on Sunday. So they kind of grew up playing in the favelas, which they were far more comfortable with. So it was just really interesting to have kind of my stereotypes challenged about where the Brazilian footballers were coming from. And my one disappointment to the trip was we went to Ipanema, and there's a bar there called Lord Nelson's Tavern, and we went there about 4 or 5 times purely on the off chance of meeting Ronnie Biggs, because apparently that was his local in Rio, and sadly we never got to see him, and that disappointment's never gone away.
But I think Paul's trying to claim that he spotted Ronaldo as a kid.
Well, you take a percentage of that. Yeah, if you've got a percentage of that. Okay, guys, last thing then. It's article nomination time, because that's what I've called that now as well. So in terms of, the magazine, like we said, the first thing we do is we look at the pictures that have been used, the artists, the photographs. We don't read our own article, and then we go to the article that we do want to read. So obviously, Paul, you've got the, like I said, you've got the great joy of writing about Zico, but where are you going once the magazine arrives?
I think I'll go for the article that's been written about the Fluminense Flamengo derby game. So I'm always really interested in derby games and the rivalry between clubs and how that's developed, how that affects the city, how the rival fans view each other, and the implications of one team having a period of superiority compared to the other team, and how the cyclical change happens in football within that. So I think the one article I'll go for will be that one.
Okay. Stephen, for you... You can pick Zico if you want. That's fine. You can go right ahead.
Zico, definitely Zico.
It means that Aidan can't. But once you've looked at your own images, you've read Paul's article, then where are you going?
I'm going for Will's homage to Ronaldinho. You know, I think everyone thinks of him as at Barcelona. You know, his time with Milan, and you know, so just all of these kind of like, I don't know, recall images of him. You know, and none of them for me tend to be of him in a Flamengo shirt. But Will have found the, you know, the perfect hook for it. And you know, the way that Will embosses his articles, this cannot be anything other than a joy to read. You know, massively looking forward to that.
Brilliant. Aidan, for you, where are you heading once the magazine drops through the letterbox onto your mat?
Yeah, well, I'm going to go further back in time, and the article on Leonidas da Silva, I think that appeals to me greatly, because he's a hugely iconic player of the 1930s, of Brazil's early World Cup sojourns, and one of the earlier exponents of the bicycle kick as well. And, his name's in history for that and for some of his scoring feats. It's an era that totally fascinates me in many ways, the 1930s and some of the greats of that time and the World Cups of that time. So I don't know much about him or anything about him from a club side of things. So that would be really interesting to me. All I know about him really is his World Cup exploits for the national team. So I think getting a bit of the extra background on that, I think that'll be absolutely fascinating. So that's another one I'm very much keen on, as well as Zico.
Once of all read Paul's article about his bus trip. Like I said, guy, you know, it's been another brilliant episode, brilliant podcast. Like we say, the magazine clearly is just going to engender a lot of joy for the people who get it. But like I said before, you know, it is on sale now. So if you're listening to this, it's already on sale. Like I said, pause it before you find out if Paul gets off the bus or not. Order it and then find out what happens on the bus. It's been brilliant. You know, the Battle of the Tens is out there. Did you guys all write for the Battle of the Tens as well?
One of my Zico articles, I did Zico for that one. So yeah.
Oh, Paul, yeah. It just gets worse for you.
Double Zico.
So that magazine fell before my time.
Oh. Yeah. Likewise, Aidan.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm looking forward to reading that as well. So there's a whole load more articles I'm very much keen to get into.
I had the joy of pitching Maradona against Lionel Messi for that one, and who was the great better player. Like I say, it's been brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us, guys. Stephen, enjoy it.
Oh, it's been an absolute joy. And we've not even mentioned that, you know, when Germany went to Brazil to win the World Cup, they, you know, tried to win hearts and minds by wearing a changed strip that was Flamengo's colours. Took Brazil apart in the semi-finals of the 2014 World Cup in Brazil, in Flamengo colours. You know, it testament to just how iconic and, you know, I don't know, eulogised that this football team has become. You know, so caught in the mind's eye of not just us, but clearly a whole generation of football lovers in Germany as well.
Brilliant. Paul, like I say, I knew you would have a story for this podcast. Like I say, you never ever let me down. You enjoyed it? Looking forward to the magazine?
Oh, absolutely, Stuart. I mean, as I think we said at the start, you know, the Flamengo are the only Brazilian team I've watched live play in the home country. So yeah, I always had the affinity with them, but based on that alone. But yeah, I mean, as Steam has outlined there, you know, they are the club side by which every other club side in Brazil is judged. Arguably, you could say they're the standard by which every side in South America is judged as well. But there's such a rich history, there's such a legacy of fantastic players. And I can't wait to start reading the magazine, because, I mean, the article there that Aidan's referenced, the articles that Steve's referenced as well, I really can't wait to sit down and, you know, just basically devote 3 or 4 hours to read it and then go back and read it again because, oh, I don't know about you guys, I find I miss stuff. I want to go back and just double-check things. And it leads you to explore other things after reading the article. And no, and I would say this, wouldn't I? But the quality of writing from the team who produced the magazines and have the articles in is absolutely outstanding. And you know, not everyone in the These Football Times team can actually make the cut to get their stuff in the magazine. So it is a really, really high bar. And when you're competing with your articles against the likes of Stu with his best-selling Brazil book, you know you've really, really got to be on top form. Otherwise, you know, you're just not going to make the cut.
Oh, Paul, I don't know what to say to that. Thank you. We'll move quickly on, Aidan. You can wrap this up. Like I say, it's... Hopefully, this will be a magazine of joy, I think is probably how I would describe it. I don't think there's any, looking at the articles, I don't think there's much sadness in this magazine.
It, just like any good Maverick player, Stu, this will be a magazine full of joy, excitement, and living the high life. And that's how it should be, because this is Rio's club, isn't it? That's how could it not be the high life? But yes, it's going to be absolutely magnificent. I'm really looking forward to getting stuck into reading it. And beyond this, I'm hoping it would be great if this led on to other magazines on clubs away from Europe as well, or other aspects of the world game. That are perhaps less familiar to people back here. And that's part of the fascination, I think, of this magazine. It's familiar up to a point, but so much that will be in this magazine will be unfamiliar, I think, to a lot of people. And that should be really, really interesting.
What a great way to finish. Great way to finish. So the last time I'm going to say it, the magazine is on sale. Don't get this far without pausing the podcast and still not ordering it, because the chances are it's sold out now we've been going on for that long. It probably sold out while we've been recording. Guys, thank you ever so much for joining us. All that's left me to say is thank you, and please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.